Chapter 9. Conclusion. We are now in a position to see the place occupied by the individual in the creative order. We have found that the originating and maintaining force of the whole creative process is the self-contemplation of the spirit, and that this necessarily produces a reciprocal corresponding to the idea embodied in the contemplation, and thus manifesting that idea in a correlative form. We have found that in this way, the externalization of the idea progresses from the condensation of the primary nebula to the production of human beings as a race, and that at this point, the simple generic reproduction of the idea terminates. This means that up to and including genus Homo, the individual, whether plant, animal or man, is what is simply by reason of race conditions, and not by exercise of deliberate choice. Then we have seen that the next step in advance must necessarily be by the individual becoming aware that he has power to mould the conditions of his own consciousness and environment by the creative power of his thought, thus not only enabling him to take a conscious part in his own further evolution, but precluding him from evolving any further except by the right exercise of this power. And we have found that the crux of the passage from the fourth to the fifth kingdom is to get people so to understand the nature of their creative power as not to use it destructively. Now what we require to see is that the creative process has always only one way of working, and that is by reciprocity or reflection, or as we might say, by the law of action and reaction, the reaction being always equivalent and corresponding to the action which generated it. If this law of reciprocity be grasped, then we see how the progress of the creative process must at length result in producing a being who himself possesses the power of independent spiritual initiative, and is thus able to carry on the creative work from the standpoint of his own individuality. Now the great crux is first to get people to see that they possess this power at all, and then to get them to use it in the right direction. When our eyes begin to open to the truth that we do possess this power, the temptation is to ignore the fact that our power of initiative is itself a product of the similar power subsisting in the all-originating spirit. If this origin of our own creative faculty is left out of sight, we shall fail to recognize the livingness of the greater life within which we live. We shall never get nearer to it than what we may call its generic level, the stage at which the creative power is careful of the type or race, but is careless of the individual. And so at this level, we shall never pass into the fifth kingdom, which is the kingdom of individuality. We have missed the whole point of the transition to the more advanced mode of being, in which the individual consciously functions as a creative centre. Because we have no conception of a universal power that works at any higher level than the generic, and consequently, to reach a specific personal exercise of creative power, we should have to conceive of ourselves as transcending the universal law. But if we realise that our own power of creative initiative has its origin in the similar faculty of the all-originating mind, then we see that the way to maintain the life-giving energy in ourselves is to use our power of spiritual initiative so as to impress upon the spirit the conception of ourselves as standing related to it in a specific, individual and personal way that takes us out of the mere category of genus Homo and gives us a specific spiritual individuality of our own. Thus, our mental action produces a corresponding reaction in the mind of the spirit, which in its turn reproduces itself as a special manifestation of the life of the spirit within us. And so long as this circulation between the individual spirit and the great spirit is kept up, the individual life will be maintained and will also strengthen as the circulation continues. For the reason that the spirit, as the original creative power, is a multiplying force, and the current sent into it is returned multiplied. Just as in telegraphy, the feeble current received from a distance at the end of a long line operates to start a powerful battery in the receiving office, which so multiplies the force as to give out a clear message, which, but for the multiplication of the original movement, could not have been done. Something like this, we may picture the multiplying tendency of the originating mind, and consequently, the longer the circulation between it and the individual mind goes on, the stronger the latter becomes, and this process, growing habitual, becomes at last automatic, thus producing an endless flow of life, continually expanding in intelligence, love, power and joy. But we must note carefully that all this can only proceed from the individual's recognition that his own powers are a derivative from the all-originating spirit, and that they continue to be used constructively only so long as they are employed in harmony with the inherent forward movement of the spirit. Therefore, to ensure this eternally flowing stream of life from the universal spirit into the individual, there must be no inversion in the individual's presentation of himself to the originating power. For through the very same law by which we seek life, the life, namely, of reciprocal action and reaction, every inversion we bring with us in presenting ourselves to the spirit is bound to be faithfully reproduced in a corresponding reaction, thus adulterating the stream of pure life, and rendering it less life-giving in proportion to the extent to which we invert the action of the life principle. So that in extreme cases, the stream flowing through and from the individual may be rendered absolutely poisonous and deadly. The more so, the greater his recognition of his own personal power to employ spiritual forces. The existence of these negative possibilities in the spiritual world should never be overlooked, and therefore the essential condition for receiving the perfect fullness of life is that we should present ourselves before the eternal spirit, free from every trace of aversion. To do this means to present ourselves in the likeness of the divine ideal, and in this self-presentation, the initiative, so far as the individual is consciously concerned, must necessarily be taken by himself. He is to project into the eternal mind the conception of himself as identical with its eternal ideal. And if he can do this, then by the law of the creative process, a return current will flow from the eternal mind, reproducing this image in the individual with a continually growing power. Then the question is, how are we to do this? The answer is that to take the initiative for inducing this flow of life individually, it is a sine qua non that the conditions enabling us to do so should first be presented to us universally. This is in accordance with the general principle that we can never create a force, but can only specialize it. Only here the power we are wanting to specialize is the very power of specialization itself. And therefore, paradoxical as it may seem, what we require to have shown to us is the universality of specialization. Now, this is what the Bible puts before us in its central figure. Taking the Bible statement simply and literally, they show us this unique personality as the principle of humanity, alike in its spiritual origin and its material manifestation, carried to the logical extreme of specialization, while at the same time, as the embodiment of the original polarity of spirit and substance, this personality, however unique, is absolutely universal, so that the Bible sets Jesus Christ before us as the answer to the philosophic problem of how to specialize the universal, while at the same time preserving its universality. If then we fix our thought upon this unique personality as the embodiment of universal principles, it follows that those principles must exist in ourselves also, and that his actual specialization of them is the earnest of our potential specialization of them. Then if we fix our thought on this potential in ourselves as being identical with its manifestation in him, we can logically claim our identity with him, so that what he has done, we have done, what he is, we are, and thus recognizing ourselves in him, we present this image of ourselves to the eternal mind, with the result that we bring with us no aversion, and, so important, no negative current into our stream of life. Thus it is that we reach the Father through Son, and that he is able to keep us from falling and to present us faultless before the presence of the divine glory with exceeding joy. The gospel of the world made flesh is not the meaningless cant of some petty sect, nor yet the cunning device of priestcraft, though it has been distorted in both these directions. But it can give a reason for itself, and is founded upon the deepest laws of the threefold constitution of man, embracing the whole man, body, soul, and spirit. It is not opposed to science, but is the culmination of all science, whether physical or mental. It is philosophical and logical throughout if you start the creative process where alone it can start, in the self-contemplation of the spirit. The more carefully we examine into the claims of the gospel of Christ, the more we shall find all the current objections to it melt away and disclose their own superficialness. We shall find that Christ is indeed the mediator between God and man, not by the arbitrary fiat of a capricious deity, but by a logical law of sequence which solves the problem of making extremes meet, so that the Son of Man is also the Son of God. And when we see the reason why this is so, we thereby receive the power to become ourselves sons of God, which is the denouement of the creative process in the individual. These closing lines are not the place to enter upon so great a subject, but I hope to follow it up in another volume and to show in detail the logic of the Bible teaching, what it saves us from and what it leads us to. To show, while giving due weight to the value of other systems, how it differs from them and transcends them, to glance, perhaps for a moment, at the indications of the future, and to touch upon some of the dangers of the present and the way to escape from them. Nor will I pass over in silence another and important aspect of the gospel contained in Christ's commission to his followers to heal the sick. This also follows logically from the law of the creative process, if we trace carefully the sequence of connections from the indwelling ego to the outermost of its vehicles. While the effect of the recognition of these great triumphs upon the individuality that it has for a time put off its robe of flesh, opens out a subject of paramount interest. Thus it is that on every plane Christ is the fulfilling of the law, and that salvation is not a silly shibboleth, but the logical and vital process of our advance into the unfoldment of the next stage of the limitless capacities of our being. Of these things I hope to write in another volume, should it be permitted to me. And in the meanwhile, I would commend the present abstract statement of principles to the reader's attention, in the hope that it may throw some light on the fundamental nature of these momentous questions. The great thing to bear in mind is that if a thing is true at all, there must be a reason why it is true. And when we come to see this reason, We know the truth at first hand for ourselves, and not from someone else's report. Then it becomes really our own, and we begin to learn how to use it. This is the secret of the individual's progress in any art, science, or business, and the same method will serve equally well in our search after life itself. And as we thus follow up the great quest, we shall find that on every plane, the way, the truth, and the life are one. A little philosophy inclineth a man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion. Bacon, Essay 16.